and welcome to the SAGE podcast of Critical Sociology's Labor Scholar Series. I'm Graham Cassano, culture and media editor for Critical Sociology.
Fran Shore is a professor of history at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. He is the author of numerous works, including Utopianism and Radicalism in a Reforming America, 1888 to 1918. Recently, we had the opportunity to talk about the construction of whiteness in America.
Let's begin with, what is whiteness in post-racial America? Does the term describe an individual identity, a social structure of white supremacy, or some combination of factors?
I definitely think it's a combination. And let's step back to just try to put the concept of whiteness into some kind of theoretical framework, and then also after that, put it into a historical framework. It seems to me that the underlying definition of whiteness is a hierarchy based upon racial privilege. It gets constructed over time, constructed in place, and it gets mediated by other factors, by class, by gender, by sexual orientation, etc. So if we have to identify then the contributing factors to what constitutes whiteness, you have to think about racial privilege, you have to think about how that's constructed historically, and you have to think then also about the ways in which that leads to the kind of othering of other ethnicities based upon that kind of hierarchy and privilege. So whiteness becomes historically often a way in which people are defined against the other. And it's done over a long period of time in the process of the construction of a racial hierarchy, emerging out of Western European enslavement, Western European imperial development, and that comes as early as England moving into Ireland and othering the Irish. All of this, I think, is part then of a structure of domination. And within that structure of domination, one has a hierarchy of privilege and power. The construction then of whiteness will change, obviously, over time as we get the shifting of privilege and the shifting of power, the contesting of privilege and the contesting of power.
What does whiteness look like in post-racial America? What does whiteness look like in a colorblind society?
It takes on a continuum of identities, but a lot of this has, again, historical roots, so that the longest and sort of continuing trope that I call paranoid whiteness has its roots really deeply in the white settler colonialism. That is the othering of the indigenous people of the North American continent and enslavement of Africans. So that paranoid whiteness, which you can trace back to that early settlement patterns, nonetheless persists over time and then goes through a series of transformations. So that in the contemporary period, I think what we see of that defensive or paranoid whiteness is the fear on the part of whites articulated by right-wing forces that somehow they are losing power and privilege, that they fear of a black planet, so to speak, that the sense that what happens when you think about Obama's policies from the perspective of a Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh, who articulate this paranoid whiteness, the belief that everything is about reparations, that Obama hates white people, that any governmental move is really about giving things to people of color and taking away from white people. And you have various political candidates that articulated that kind of paranoid whiteness, Rick Santorum and that famous ad about Obamaville during the Republican primaries. Or you can go back to Pat Buchanan and also his fear of, you know, the increasing immigration issue and the decline of the white race. Now, again, this isn't new. One can go back to the beginning of the 20th century and hear that same kind of racist articulations and representations. But what it does is in this era, that is the 21st century, it takes on a particular targeting of others, whether they're Latinos or African Americans or Asians. What you see in general is then this fear and paranoia.
What are the other modes of whiteness?
The two other ones that are the dominant expressions or representations are what I call, and what other analysts have called, including Bonilla Silva, among others, colorblind whiteness and a post-racial whiteness. I would say clearly Obama is a representation of post-racialism and a post-racialism that's inflected by neoliberalism. That is an effort to try to think beyond race, to use universalist categories, often relying on the market to make these kinds of distinctions. And again, these are post-civil rights expressions. They're a way of trying to recuperate white privilege in the aftermath of the victories of the Black freedom struggle and the modern civil rights movement. And colorblind whiteness is, in a sense, a critique of preferential policies. It's a critique of affirmative action. It's basically saying we shouldn't be privileging African Americans or Latinos any longer because we have a playing field now that's equal. And which, of course, is a deep illusion, and I'd say even a delusion, because the playing field, as we know, in housing, in health, in education, et cetera, is not level. There's still racial privileging. There's still a hierarchy involved. And therefore, colorblind whiteness and post-racial whiteness are ideologies. Ideologies which, again, occlude the persistence of white racial privilege. Now, again, when I say white racial privilege, obviously it has different meanings for different class locations. It's not like everybody has, you know, privilege in a system which still has deep-seated class oppression. So we have this notion of colorblind whiteness, and which is in effect a way of saying that civil rights now is really about whites who have been persecuted.
Right.
You know, so you get the Wade Connolly kinds of propositions out in California that made their way around the country, effectively here in the state of Michigan, also outlawing the use of affirmative action because it was seen, you know, to violate colorblind whiteness, which was in effect to say that all the remedies that we need are legally on board, and therefore we don't need to provide any other legal remedies for people of color. And, you know, which is just, again, if you look at the statistics, flies in the face, right, persistence of inequities in health, education, you know, housing, et cetera, et cetera. Also, I think the way in which both white colorblindness and post-racialism get inflected by the cultural modality of individualism is that fundamentally, this is about, as Derek Bell says, colorblindness is more about the indolence of blacks rather than the injustice of whites.
Right.
That defines and identifies why there's a persistence of these gaps in wealth and housing, et cetera.
So what's the path to racial justice? What's this fourth category that you call anti-racist whiteness?
The first step is recognizing that it exists. Recognizing that the problem still persists, that there are these racial injustices that persist, and that ever since, again, the modern civil rights movement, when whites and students, white students in particular, began to participate as activists in that black freedom struggle, they realized that their own whiteness was to be questioned. And questioned in a thoroughgoing way, so that they had to be in a kind of liminal space where they made an effort to understand the nature of the whiteness and to try to transcend that. Now, that wasn't always possible because, you know, you had kids going down south and working and struggling to bring some kind of racial justice, and then they could always return to their positions of privilege.
Right.
So there are those contradictions. And I think that's what anti-racist whites have to always be aware of, that there are these contradictions and that the struggle is persistent.
But I think you're also hitting on one of the limitations, the potential limitations of an anti-racist discourse, which is to see it as possible to overcome racism in an individual's life, right? I mean, this kind of anti-racist discourse can lead one to a certain kind of celebration of agency.
Yes.
And ignoring the structure of white supremacy that continues to exist, even as anti-racist whites work against it. So I'd like you to differentiate between these categories that kind of end your paper, the difference between deconstructing and decentering whiteness, which you're presumably doing in this paper, on the one hand, and delegitimating it, which is a much more, it sounds like a much more structural concept to me.
The deconstructing of it is, in fact, a kind of cognitive act. And that's, of course, historically bounded, and you can't fully have that realized unless it's enacted within a collective struggle. So while that's a cognitive act that's at some point, the delegitimatizing element of that is the need to make a kind of effective leap, that what is required is engaging in struggles that are going to contest and erode white racial privilege. The deconstructing and the decentering, it seems to me, is more on the level of the kind of analysis and on the part of a cognitive framing of things. Whereas when you move to delegitimatize, that certainly has that kind of cognitive component. But it also, it means it's a necessity to engage in practice and engage in struggle, that has some affective life. It has some emotional resonance to it. That's what is the most transformative. One of the great little moments, I think, of how you can make that transformative leap comes in a description in Studs Terkel's Working. It's about this white guy who had grown up in the Klan, this was in the South, and who had gone to work in this factory where the majority of workers were black women. In the process of struggling around some very real issues in the workplace, he became a kind of shop steward. And as he talks about it, he says that in struggling with these black women and other black workers in this workplace, what he realized is they did have some things in common. They weren't all that different in the way that he had been raised. And so there's both the cognitive transformation that he sees in that environment. But without struggling in that environment, he wouldn't have had, it seems to me, that emotional movement that made him realize that the white supremacy that he had been born into and that he had harbored as a member of the Klan was a delusional position when it came to, you know, any kind of social justice.
Oh, and so we don't so much transcend or overcome racism as we do forge new communities.
Exactly. Good. And I think that's key. Because it's in those communities of resistance that you can make the beginnings of those transformations.
Yeah.
Thank you, Professor Fran Shore of Wayne State University. Thanks to Roz Hartigan for engineering and production.
This podcast series was made possible in part through a grant from Wayne State University. I'm Graham Cassano, Culture and Media Editor for Critical Sociology. Critical Sociology is a quarterly journal published by Sage. For more information, please visit our website, crs.sagepub.com.